This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. We would like to welcome Dr. Lior Zilberman to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Zilberman is an associate professor in UBC's Department of Mathematics. That's good?
Yeah. Hello. Okay.
Hi. It's a pleasure to have you on. Could you start by telling us maybe a bit about yourself and what got you interested in mathematics?
I was interested in mathematics since I was very young. So I grew up in Israel, my father did several things, but among other things, he did a master's in mathematics and physics, and then he worked as a computer programmer for some years, then he was a PhD student in economics, then he went to do business. But among all of this, there was lots of talking about math and riddles and things like this, and kind of was interested. I mean, but the truth is that everything is interesting, right? So it's not that when I was very little, I said, okay, I'm going to be a mathematician and that's it. It's more that kind of everything is interesting. I did some more math and other things. I did some high school math contests. I took some first year university math courses when I was in the last year of high school. And then I did my military service, and then I came back to actually do my undergraduate degree. During military service, I did some more first year courses, and then I did a degree in math and physics. So that was in Jerusalem. And when I finished, there was the big choice. Okay, do I do graduate work in mathematics or in physics? And it was kind of hard to decide, but you could only apply to one graduate school. And eventually I decided I'll apply to math graduate school. And so I did some graduate work in the US. I was at Princeton for several years. And then I did postdoctoral positions at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton and at Harvard. And then finally I arrived at UBC, and I've been at UBC since 2008.
Great. Yeah. I noticed that you teach Math 100, which is the first year math course. So you're probably used to teaching a lot of people that don't really like math or are pretty scared of math. What are some of the difficulties in teaching those kinds of students?
So I don't think students who take Math 100 are really in that category so much. Mm. I occasionally teach Math 100, right? That's the big calculus course for science students.
Yeah.
One of three, actually. That's more of the natural science and physical sciences, engineering. I don't think most of the students in this course really don't like or are afraid of math. Most of such students would be unlikely to show up at that course. But certainly, what's a better way to think about it is that most of these students haven't seen mathematics before. So the truth, which is not so visible in Math 100, is that mathematics really is a way of thinking. I mean, mathematics is kind of two things. One of them is it's a way of thinking. And the other is that it's a language that we can use to talk about other things, about the world around us generally. And Math 100 and most of our service and math major courses are more on this language side. Mm-hmm. So the goal of Math 100 is to teach students in science and engineering the language of mathematics so they can talk about other things, right? So you can talk about epidemiological models, or you can talk about physical systems, or you can talk about the stresses on a bridge. It doesn't matter what the physical system you talk about, but mathematics is the language we talk about, we used to talk. And mathematics is also a way of thinking. That part you don't see so much in Math 100. That's the part of making mathematicians look a little bit like aliens, right? In the sense that, right? I mean, so the main thing is that when we teach Math 100, we don't teach mathematics in that way. And I think this is the main kind of main distinction between the two kinds of math courses that we offer.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Start off your new year with a new skill. This spring, Emily Carr University's Continuing Studies is proud to offer courses and workshops online and in person. Choose from over 100 courses, from weekend workshops designed for beginners to skills-focused certificate programs. Whether you're seeking an artistic outlet or looking to add to your professional skill toolkit, Emily Carr has you covered. From painting to print media, industrial design to web design, there's something for everyone. Find your fit at ecuad.ca/cs. Register now and commit to your creative future.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, and today we are interviewing Dr. Lior Zilberman, an associate professor in UBC's Department of Mathematics. So, Gurman, you had something to ask.
Yeah, so like we had an email discussion earlier about some of the topics we should maybe talk about that are appropriate to talk about to a general audience in a short period of time. And we sort of settled upon the topics of quantum chaos and modular knots. What is it about these topics that you think are more amenable for like a casual conversation?
So mathematics is something that we've been thinking about for a long time. I mean, humanity. And even rigorous mathematics is something that's in many ways thousands of years old. And one of the special thing about mathematics is that we've kind of resolved to only say true statements. I mean, if you're in mathematics, it's the branch of philosophy where we only say true things. And there's a price and a loss for this. I mean, the gain from this is that we kind of, things that are true are always true, right? Physicists discovered the thing they thought true are in some ways not true anymore. Even that's not exactly a fair thing because, I mean, but we can think about it this way, or biologists or chemistry, and certainly in social sciences, right? And in mathematics, this largely just doesn't happen, right? I mean, when Euclid proved theorems in Euclidean geometry, they're still true today. And similarly for many calculations done all over the world in ancient times. And what this means is that over 2,500 years, we've made quite a bit of progress. And by now, many of the ideas we think about are pretty hard, kind of a pretty far removed from what, I mean, kind of we've build and build and build kind of pyramids and pyramids and pyramids. It's very hard to connect, kind of, I mean, the things we want to talk about, right? And it helps us that that we can find enough structures that in some way most of the problems we think about are not intractably complicated. And when they are, we actually struggle a lot. Right. Let's say biology or economics tries to study systems that are far more complicated than what mathematicians usually try to do. And because of this, I mean, the reason they say less about the problems they study that we do is not because kind of, it's because their problems are so much harder than ours, right? It's not that they're taking the easy way out. It's just these problems are so hard that that kind of what we've managed to learn in biology is a major success. And similarly, economics or other social sciences, and so these kind of features make it that if I, let's say, want to talk about things that I've done, let's say number theory, the kind of by now the concepts that we're talking about are already kind of very far removed from things that unless you have a lot of background in mathematics, you can talk about.
Right.
Another example I use is sometimes when you, if you go talk, I mean, medicine is a similar, is kind of like you go talk to a doctor. So the kind of, on the one hand, if you look at papers, like scientific papers in medicine, they are not complicated by the standards of mathematics. You say, why can't mathematicians just be very good doctors? The answer is the difficulty is not in reading the paper, which says we've done a study and those people had the kind of statistics. If you go to the doctor has years of intuition and understanding about how things work. And the real question is, okay, you are not quite like the people in the study. There's enormous expertise, right? And right, I mean, you can't pretend to be a doctor just because you read some papers, right? Mm-hmm. And right, I mean, you can understand the general ideas maybe of think of kind of very basic, but there's a lot of like, do the things in this paper actually apply to you? Well, how similar are you to the people, right? I mean, there's a lot of knowledge that is not there. And right, I mean, and the doctor has it, right? Either in the form of actual book knowledge they've learned, a lot of it is intuition and understanding about how to connect things. And so mathematicians similarly develop all this knowledge, and without it, it's hard to actually have a, you know, explain really what how you came to this or that conclusion you're thinking about. But some of the things we study sometimes do have some more concrete pictures or concrete connections. And then even if it's not possible to literally describe what you're doing, you can kind of draw pictures of things that people understand. So the problems we talked about earlier are two connected problems. So for example, so one of them is this question of quantum chaos. So to start with, let me introduce the idea of dynamics. So you know, I mean, I think most people know what a billiard table is. So mathematical billiard tables don't have the cushions, but they don't have the pockets. So it's just some area, some enclosed area in the plane. And you have one billiard ball, which you hit with your cue. And then this billiard ball goes around the table in straight lines until it hits the cushion, and then it rebounds according to the usual laws of reflection. And of course, mathematicians can idealize things. So our billiard table is completely smooth and completely frictionless, and the ball just keeps going. So I take my cue ball, I put it on the table, I hit it with my cue ball, and it goes. And it reflects from the cushions, and it keeps going infinitely in time. And, okay, so you can ask the basic questions of physics. What's the goal of physics? To predict the future, right? If I know where things are now, where will it be later? And kind of first-year physics says, yes, this is actually in some sense fairly easy. You just say, okay, it goes in straight lines. When it rebounds, it rebounds. And you can just keep track of the trajectory of the path of the billiard ball around the table. So let's start with some simple observation. Just knowing where the billiard ball is isn't enough to predict the future. If I know where the billiard ball is right now, I still can't tell where it's going to be later. I need one more piece of information, the direction that it's going. But if I know where it is and which way it's going right now, I'll be able to tell you 10 years from now exactly when it's going to be and which direction it's going in principle, right? Those are just Newton's laws of motion. But the truth is more complicated. So if your billiard table is the usual kind of rectangular kind, then yes, that's all there is to it. Because if you think about it, on a rectangular billiard table, there's actually going to be only four directions that the billiard ball will ever go. It's going to go in some direction. When it's going to reflect, when it's going to rebound from the boundary, it's going to turn 90 degrees. When it's going to rebound again, it's going to turn another 90 degrees and go in the opposite direction. Then it's going to turn again. And in the fourth turn, it'll start going in this original direction. So actually, it's going to wander all over the table. It's usually going to wander in many complicated ways. But its directions will be very simple. I know in advance which directions are allowed to it, right? And I can, and because of this, I can actually keep track of its motion for a pretty long time. So now you can do something more complicated, which mathematicians like to do. You can curve a little bit the boundary, right? Let's say replace the, I mean, take a rectangle, but add to curve the sides. We call this a stadium because it looks exactly like a football stadium, right? With a round inside, right? On both sides. And now something more interesting happens. Because you see, now when you hit the curved sides, your direction can change. And every time you reflect from the curved side, your direction changes in kind of more and more in unpredictable ways. What happens is, if you hit the curved sides or don't, it can cause your angle to change. Okay, so what's the difference between these two tables? On the stadium table, on the one with the curved sides, the motion is a lot more irregular. So in theory, a physicist could calculate where it's going to be in 10 years from now, but the truth is that they can't. And the reason is, if you make a little change in the initial direction or the initial position, very quickly, it's going to completely diverge and do a different thing. So this is what we call chaos. Mm-hmm. So quantum chaos, so we start with chaos, right? So chaos means that I have something like this stadium, this billiard table with curved sides, where because the reflections kind of amplify angles, it's impossible to really predict the future. And of course, there are real world systems like this, like the weather, right? The weather is famously chaotic. It's one of the things that makes predicting the weather hard and the climate even harder, right? That if I mean, and even with a very powerful computer, with our best ability to understand what the weather is right now and to compute, there are no reliable weather forecasts that go, let's say, 2 weeks in the future. Really reliable, right? But if you want the weather tomorrow, we can calculate. Right? The weather forecast for tomorrow is fairly reliable. For 2 weeks, it's not. And the reason is exactly that the system is so complicated that if your estimate is a little bit off today, this error will keep amplifying and amplifying and amplifying. And by 2 weeks from now, it's only all noise and no signal. Mm-hmm. Which is a chaotic system. So we saw there's this distinction when things change in time between kind of very orderly systems like the rectangle and very chaotic system like the stadium, this curved rectangle or the weather. And there are many other examples of chaotic systems. If you take a pendulum and you connect two pendulums to each other, so you take two arms. Maybe engineers are used to this anharmonic oscillator. You take two arms and you hang one of them from some hanging point, and then you let the two arms articulate from a common joint.
No.
Right? So this thing also becomes completely unpredictable.
One question, because you mentioned the weather is an example of a complicated chaotic system, and you said that the computers today, they're not able to predict it farther than 2 weeks in advance. Would you say that in the future there could be advancements that would help us predict weather, say, months in advance? Would that be possible?
So I think the way to think about this, the system is sufficiently complicated. Mm-hmm. Of course, with a more powerful computer, you could end with better weather. I mean, you need two things. You need to know the weather right now more accurately, mm-hmm. and you need a better computer that can handle all the information. You could predict it further into the future, but you will need, but kind of adding a day to the forecast will become increasingly harder the further into the future you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So going from 1 to 2 days requires some more computing power, but going from, let's say, 14 to 15 days require even more computing power. It's much harder. Right? Mm-hmm. Now it's also becoming cheaper and cheaper to buy more computing power. Right? Computers become more powerful over time. And I am not an expert on the weather, so I can't tell you exactly how the interface between these two things goes. Right? So I can't tell you to estimate the power of weather prediction in the future. But I can only describe the general picture, which is that not knowing precisely enough the weather today has bigger and bigger effect on the future.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, not being able to precisely enough compute how the weather works creates its own implication. And we have estimates. I mean, scientists have estimates about how computers are becoming more powerful. And I'm sure that people with expertise on the weather have put these two together to get a general idea. But I don't know for myself where exactly this is going to go. Right. It's an example I use often in my calculus class about exponential growth. There's another aspect of this prediction. There's a related calculation that I actually know more about, but to give a flavor of the kind of calculation I have to do. So there is a device called the Large Hadron Collider. It's at least at some point, it was, I think, the largest machine made by man, which is in Switzerland, on the border between Switzerland and France. It's this tunnel of several kilometers under the border. The headquarters are in Switzerland in an institute called CERN. And this is a particle accelerator. So what they do is they accelerate subatomic particles and collide them together in order to look at what comes out in order to learn about the properties of subatomic calculators. The tunnel itself in CERN has been for a long time. And every decade, 2 decades or something, they replace the existing accelerator with a more powerful one.
Mm-hmm.
The current one is called the Large Hadron Collider. It collides large hadron, meaning large nuclei with each other. And the interesting story about this is that when they started designing this machine, that was in the late 80s and early 90s, right? So they said, we are going to eventually build this machine, right? I mean, it cost billions of dollars. It gave years to build. It's the work of huge collaborations of thousands of people. They already needed, so these collisions generate tremendous amounts of information, far more information than any that could be recorded on hard drives or kept in memory. And so they have computers whose job is to look at each collision, look at the data, and see, is this something interesting or is this something we have to throw out? They can't keep all the data they generate, right? They generate tremendous amounts of data. And so they started writing, and so they needed to write computer programs that will operate the detectors. But here's the interesting thing. In order to for the computer programs to run in the early 2000s when the machine starts to work, the graduate students has to start writing them in the late 80s and early 90s. And you can guess where this is going. This means that the physicists of 1990 had to predict what the computers of 2005 will be able to do. Mm. And so when they started writing the software, they wrote it for based on assumptions about what the computers of the future will be able to do to run the software. Mm-hmm. And the surprising thing, it actually worked. So
they were right. The predictions were right.
The predictions were right. And the computers worked. And now the physics community is starting discussions kind of on what the next colliders should be and how to lobby the various governments for money, right? This is a very expensive undertaking. And I'm sure at the same time, they're thinking, okay, what do we, they're starting to work on ideas of how to make it work. And they're going back to making predictions about future computers. And right, and as you can see here, this is more, and we're coming back more to mathematics as a way of describing the world around us, right? We have mathematical models that we're trying to calculate, right? We have, in this case, we even have a mathematical model of just the progress of computers so we can predict computers of the future and less about proving things to be true in math.
Great. We'll be right back here after one short message.
Interested in making radio? How about hosting your own show? At CITR, you can make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From news, art, sports, to gender empowerment, accessibility, music, and the BIPOC collective, there's definitely something for everyone. Explore new worlds both virtually and at our station, and be prepared to have a blast with some new pals. For more information or to join, please visit citr.ca/get-involved.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we are interviewing Dr. Lior Zilberman, so let's get right back to our interview, Gurman.
A lot of your description on chaos and chaotic systems is pretty reminiscent of, I saw Jurassic Park growing up. Have you seen that movie by any chance?
Yes.
Yeah, there was a mathematician, Ian Malcolm, throughout the movie who was explaining through chaos theory why having dinosaurs in an amusement park is just a really bad idea.
Yeah, so that was not really mathematics. That was more artistic license taken by the author, Michael Crichton, than a fair description of what chaos theory is. Mm-hmm. This is in a way true. If you have any specialized knowledge, then you immediately recognize that movies have a fictional idea of this, right? So doctors in movies don't, medicine in movies is not real world medicine, right? There's an agreement between especially if you take a single kind of cinematic kind of language, let's say, American cinema and American movies and American television and so on. They have an agreement, so to speak, about their goal is to tell a story, and they have a language of what cinema medicine looks like, which allows them to tell a story involving medical events, right? Mm-hmm. And they have agreements about how to tell the viewer that there's an emergency now, or that the doctor has succeeded or failed, or things like this, or what is a medical event, right? And these things are not based on actual real world medicine. And the same thing is true about mathematics in movies generally. That is, if you see in that movie or in the book or it's kind of in media generally, you see a mathematician character most of the time. What they can do and the way they think is not a reflective of actual mathematics, but of the tropes of how to tell stories. The trope of the mathematician in these stories, which is a tool for telling stories. It's the same thing almost anything if you know about policing or about how martial arts work or almost anything else, right? Movie fights do not look realistic.
Yeah.
Right. And this is for many reasons, but partly it is because safety reasons. Partly it is because if you want the real actors to do this, they're probably not experts in martial arts. And a large part of it is because the typical viewer, the goal of the fight in the movie is not to instruct the viewers in how to be effective fighters or in what realistic fights look like and what the outcomes are like, but to tell a story in which fighting happens. And so there's various agreements about, you do these things there's tropes in storytelling that if the person does these things, it means they're good at fighting. And these are agreements between the people who look at the movie and the people who make the movie, independently of whether in the real world doing those things actually is a sign that you're good or is a very dangerous thing to do. Right. And it's similar in mathematics, right? There are things that the kind of Ian Malcolm in that book is kind of a plot device who gives foreshadowing, right? Who tells what's going to happen. And he does it because he has this magical thing, which is mathematics that allows him to calculate and kind of predict things. But I don't think this is a realistic portrayal of what mathematics is like. Right? So chaos theory, this is more, right? The question there was more a question of biology, from microbiology or genetics, rather than a question of, rather than a question of chaos theory. Chaos theory is not this idea that things are generally unpredictable. It's actually, it's an attempt to understand when things are unpredictable, but it's actually a formal mathematical thing with it's a much more kind of precise, it has much more precise understanding of these things, right? In a way, the questions there was more a question of decision-making than a question of mathematics. Right, it's a question of how much do you understand the world and how much you don't. And certainly quantifying that, kind of thinking rationally, trying to, right, is an important thing, and it has mathematical overtones, but it's usually not a very sophisticated mathematical question. Right, there was a famous saying by Donald Rumsfeld about this, about known unknowns, right? Like there's known knowns, right, the thing that you know and you know that you know them. There's a known unknowns. There's information that you know it exists, but you know that you don't know it. There's also unknown knowns, right? There's things that you might know, but you don't know about. And there's these unknown unknowns, right? There's things you don't know, and you don't even know that you don't know them. Right? And, he wasn't trying to be original, though. He was pilloried for some reason, right? And there are reasons to be critical or non-critical of him. But the point he was trying to make there is just a standard thing about decision-making. And that's a much better lens towards to view this interaction with Ian Malcolm, right? He's saying, there are things you don't know, and you have to be aware of the fact that things you don't know, and that and you have to weigh kind of the risks. I don't know what's going to happen. There are things that I know about, and they might have a big effect. I must be prepared for that, right? That's more that than mathematics.
I get that. Yeah, like there were things, like going back to the Jurassic Park example, there were things in the park that they were prepared for. Like they made sure they had electric fencing, they made sure all the dinosaurs were female so they wouldn't like repopulate. But then they, like, there were things they didn't take into account. Like in the book, like they have like frog DNA put into the dinosaurs, like with like the missing gaps in the DNA, and that led to them being able to change sex, because that's something some reptiles can do. And that just led to the whole park going downhill, because that was, as you said, like an unknown unknown.
There's other ways to look at this, and again, we have to be careful. It's not obvious that this is realistic microbiology and genetical engineering, right? This is right. You have to be careful in taking, I'm sure that if you had someone who's expert in molecular genetics, they would have their own things to say.
Yeah,
and we have to accept those things. The goal is to tell a fictional story. This is not supposed to be a textbook on a sort of management or a textbook on managing large projects. There's other issues. Their internal security was very weak, right? There's other tropes you can see there. Especially true in movies, even less so in books, but the number of staff that you see referenced in all of this is completely out of proportion, the number of staff you actually need to run an operation of this size. But when you're telling a story, especially in a movie, you're not going to hire hundreds of actors and show everything that they're doing. right? There's this job. I mean, should the captain of the Enterprise really be going on away missions and risk his life every week, right? Yeah. This is not a realistic way to run a military command, right? I mean, you don't see the kind of the captain of a large U.S. ship routinely board an aircraft carrier airplane and go on patrol, right? That's a completely crazy thing to do, but. But if you realistically had as many crew as you need, then the viewers wouldn't be able to recognize them, and kind of there would be too little time for each individual actor to form kind of to give lasting arcs for the actors, right? So I mean, so they kind of we have to accept this that in fictional works, kind of things are done this way for reasons of telling the story, and to some extent we can or not suspend our disbelief and live with it. I mean, example in discussion here, right? I'm painting a vain picture, but I'm not discussing kind of. I'm not trying to make things quantitative. I'm not trying to say how you could prove that things these are chaotic and these are not chaotic, right? And so, in some way, I'm also telling a story, right? I'm not really doing mathematics. And so, for example, if I want to go to even vaguer, so we discussed how a billiard ball can go around the table. But the real question I'm interested in more is not about this about this actual billiard ball, but say, suppose this billiard ball instead of a quantum particle riding on a quantum billiard table, what would happen then? And now I'll have to get even more vague because quantum mechanics is even less familiar to us than billiard balls. And so what I'm going to say is going to be even less precise and less exactly true. And partly it is because, to talk about quantum mechanics, you need a lot of mathematical language. And partly it is because you need to know various things, right? So quantum particles, the main thing to think about them is that they are kind of smeared. So you might have heard this under the idea of the uncertainty principle or things like this. In many ways, you can't know precisely where a quantum particle is. And this means that something that classical particles do, it's not clear that quantum particles can do too. So let me give you an example. In a stadium, take your favorite football stadium or sort of athletic stadium, which again, we think of as a rectangle with two arcs. And imagine a person starting at the middle, a runner starting at the middle of one of these arcs. Right. So because we're in the middle of the arc, the person is if the person is going to run directly into the stadium, they ran at right angle to exactly where the surface is. Right? OK, now let them run all the way across the stadium. What's going to happen? They'll be reflected because they're hitting exactly the wall head on. Right. So a very precise point like particle can just bounce back and forth between those two things. Similarly, a precise, very precise particle can bounce up and down between the parallel sides of our stadium, between the horizontal sides. But actual real-world situation is not quite like that. There's no exact straight lines. And the moment you deviate even a little bit from the straight line, you won't be periodic. You won't go back and forth, right? If you deviate even a little bit, you now hit the wall at some angle, and you're going to begin moving around. You're going to get completely mixed up.
Right. Yeah.
And now here's the mathematical question. Can quantum particles are somewhat smeared? Does this smearing prevent them from in some way following these unstable periodic trajectories? Or can they do it anyway? Can a quantum particle approximately follow this very, very precise trajectory, even though it's a little bit smeared, and stay along it for a long time? Or is it necessary for it to be, or is the fact that it's somewhat, in some sense, smeared, force it to kind of become more distributed than what a classical, like a point-like idealized mathematical particle could? Right? So that's a question I'm interested in. And I've studied it in various ways. As you can see, this is a question that comes from physics in some way, right? The intuition comes from physics, right? You can make it mathematically precise without physics. Right. Right. I mean, so if you wanted to mathematically precise, what you do is you take your billiard table and you replace the felt with a membrane, with a drum. You build a drum with the same boundary, with the same cushions, but now the felt is a drum. And you hit the drum and look at how it vibrates. It turns out that the musical tones of this drum, and especially the shape of the modes, how they vibrate, are exactly the states of the quantum particles.
Okay.
Let me try to say some words, not mathematics, about how I study these ideas. Right. So there are two different things that you can do in a way to approach this problem. One of them is kind of directly dealing with the physics. You say, okay, the quantum particle is a bit like more like a wave in a way, right? I mean, its motion is described by this wave equation called the Schrödinger equation. It's a wave. I mean, an equation which is in some sense similar to, it's not a wave equation in the technical sense, but it's the Schrödinger equation. It's an equation that describes the motion of this particle. And you can try to approximately solve it, right? If you've taken Math 100, you know we make a big deal about approximating functions by simpler functions, right? And this is exactly what we do here, right? We take this equation, we take a quantum particle that's reasonably localized, we know roughly where it is and where it's going, and we construct an approximate solution of the equation that kind of keep track of the particle for some time. Mm-hmm. And then we try to see, okay, if you keep track of it for a short time, it basically moves like it was a classical particle. But eventually, it begins to interfere with itself like a wave. And this interacts with the chaos of the classical movement, and we try to understand that. So that's one way of approaching these problems. In mathematical terms, it's the technology of differential equations, though.
Definitely. We'll be right back here on Research Review after two short messages, so please stay tuned.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial. Open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Every Friday at noon, CITR takes you on a journey through Thunderbird Radio Land. A journey of sound and song, of words and music, of the now and then, of the right here and the far away. It's the Eclectic Lunch, every Friday at 12 noon on Thunderbird Radio, 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Zilberman, an associate professor in UBC's Department of Mathematics. So, Gurman, I think you had a question now for Dr. Zilberman.
Yeah, I was sort of curious on how, like, the day-to-day research of that sort of thing happens and the practicality. So I guess you could run, like, experiments on a computer. But I'm assuming, like, a mathematician's day-to-day is not just, like on TV, like, staring at a board all day looking at equations.
It mostly is. I mean, we don't necessarily use boards, by the way. So, first of all, the normal state of a mathematician is confused.
Yeah.
So the usual situation in mathematics is if you're trying to solve a problem and you have no idea how to solve it. I try to tell this to all the undergraduates who are trying to do the homework problems that this is, in fact, being confused is normal. Right? Making progress is actually unusual, right? So most of my day I spent in front of a board or with a piece of paper or just thinking in my head and walking around. I mean, it's people work in different ways. A lot of it I do in conversation with people, of course, right? It's one of the fun parts of mathematics that, and I myself am a lot more productive when I'm talking to someone rather than trying to do things by myself. But most of the time we are confused and we have no idea what's going on. And we're kind of trying various things. And we are saying maybe this is true and maybe that is true, and you approach a problem from various directions. I mean, we do all the kind of things that you might think we do. For example, we say, okay, if the thing we believe is true, then here's some implication of that. Maybe that implication we can prove directly, right? I mean, like, if the thing we want to be true is true, then here is something very simple that should be also true. Maybe that we can understand all by itself. And of course, that's just a way to check whether what we think is right. And we say, okay, can we come up with a toy problem? Right? That's a very standard technique in mathematics. Can I come up with a problem which is far, far simpler than the problem I want to solve? But mm-hmm. that one, maybe I can solve because it's much, much simpler. And then I look at my solution and I say, or maybe somebody else has solved a similar problem. And right, and I look at how they did it. And maybe, right, I mean, one of the, so most of my work actually is based on exactly this. I mean, one of the techniques that I use a lot in my research is that many people are very good at coming with new ideas in the context of very concrete problems. So they look at a particular problem, a very concrete problem, and they calculate and they find how things work. And one of the techniques that I tend to use after someone has done that is look at what they've done and try to express it in more general language. Or to say, okay, they did this very concrete calculation, but I can interpret it in this more general language. And if that works, then somehow automatically I can take their ideas and make them work in other places. Right? So this is another thing you can do. But most of the time, it's kind of, right, that there's problems that we, I mean, and most of the time, right, there's problems I've been confused about for a long time. Right? There's one problem that I think I'm making progress in right now that I've been thinking about for 15 years. Right? And then I learned about some more over the years. I've thought about it. I had an idea and I made it work and my understanding increased. But then some more years before I had another idea and my understanding increased some more. And that's why, by the way, it's worthwhile. I have to work on several projects at the same time because it's hard to get progress. If you want a different picture of this, the work on the modular knots, which you haven't talked about, was actually very much based on, among other things, numerical calculations. Mm-hmm. So in that project, we definitely, I mean, both the motivation included, I sent you, the host, by email, a link to a page which has all kinds of nice pictures, which were done by computer calculation. But also one of the essential parts of the project was a summer USRA student, right? Maybe I'll make a plug for that in a minute. Who spent his summer calculating, doing numerical calculations in this example. And this created a very beautiful picture that we have no idea how to prove. So there's something that I now believe, I mean, kind of, there's a picture which I believe probably represents some truth, but I have no idea how to actually prove that this is, that the thing in the picture actually happens. Right? That if you sort of, the pattern persists beyond how much we calculate.
Yeah, I would imagine getting funding and grant money must be kind of tough if the natural state of a mathematician is confused and breakthroughs are unreliable in their pacing.
So here's something surprising about mathematics. So first of all, getting grant money is not that hard in the sense that as long as you, quite often if you think about a problem, you learn enough things that eventually you prove something. Right, so the Quantum Chaos Project has been, I've been working on it for by now almost 20 years, right? And so one aspect of it is this particular problem I'm thinking about for about 15, and I've been making slow progress. But along the way, and other parts of the project, I've made other kinds of progress, right? By myself, mostly with others, right? In mathematics, kind of, it's hard to promise that you will solve a particular problem a lot of the time. But it's surprisingly actually how often you make progress on something while you're thinking about it. And one of the things in mathematics you get to do is you can always get to draw a target over whatever you've proved and said, that's where I was going. So there are fields of research where this can be problematic for various reasons, right? If you're doing social science research, it's very important to describe in advance exactly what your study is doing and what you're trying to study, because if you ask too many questions, it's too likely that by pure chance you'll get an interesting answer. Right? If you take a population of people, like if you take 100 people and you kind of try to divide them into ask some yes no question, in which normally about half the population will say yes and half the population will say no, right? If you ask one question to these 100 people, then you probably will divide to about 50-50, not exactly, because of course real life is not exact, right? But if you ask them 20 different questions, then by pure chance, it's likely that these 100 people on that particular question will divide in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of problematic in some kinds of science it's good in you can do exploratory science and ask these kind of questions. And then you have to be very kind of skeptical sometimes. And that's one of the reasons that social science is really, really hard. In many ways, much harder than what I'm doing. It's exactly because effects like this you have to think about, right? And on the other hand, if I prove something, I know that it's true. I have a proof, right? So I can always prove it, draw a target around it, and say, that's what I proved. And there's no doubt that it's true, right? I don't have to then right? This doesn't mean to say mathematicians don't make mistakes, right? Published papers have mistakes. And we make mistakes, and sometimes we make, right? Even though other people read our work, they don't catch the mistakes. There are mistakes, but it's generally the case that if you prove something, it's actually true. You don't have to work, right? So in this way, it's easier for, right? It was this thing, I don't know how much is actually true I haven't studied empirically, but the interesting observation is that kind of you'd expect naively that somebody in the life sciences or in other experimental science would be constantly making progress, right? Every day they can go in the lab and they can measure something, or they have an experiment that you can work on every day. And on the other hand, the mathematician graduate students, most of the time they weren't making progress. They had this problem that they were thinking about for a long time. And typically they finished the day knowing about as much as they started in the morning. And yet mathematics still ended up mostly being more reliable. Somehow the experimental science students were subject to more vagaries of experimental science that put them back in various ways. And in mathematics, it was somehow easier at the end to find, okay, let's do something. We've done that. We can keep going. So in the end, you can get results in mathematics. It's not always what you promised you will do.
And right.
It's very nice in Canada that nobody goes back and checks whether, right? Nobody checks if the theorems you've proved are exactly the theorems that you promised you will prove. They just check that. They just ask, okay, have you done enough interesting things? And actually, the current funding, a lot of it is directed at students. So they don't just ask, have you done interesting things, but have your students done interesting things so that we can give you money to hire more students?
Right. Yeah, you made the comparison to social sciences. And I think a lot of the reason behind that unreliability sometimes in experimental sciences is that you're often dealing with very complex, messy systems. Whereas in mathematics, it's a lot easier, I would assume, to define your system and just make it a whole lot cleaner.
Yeah, in mathematics, in mathematics, it's easier to be precise about what I'm doing. But it's also that it's more that it's easier to isolate the particular phenomenon I'm trying to study.
Yeah.
Right. So if I'm trying to study some mathematical object, I can often set it up so that it has just the thing I'm thinking about. It's not always true. And sometimes somebody gives you the mathematical object to study, and it's really hard because it's hard to get at the parts you're interested in without, there's other things that are also there and might be hard. But in actual real life, this is not true, right? In real life systems, you cannot isolate. It's one of the reasons that physics, let's say, can do more than biology, because somehow, for some reason, in physics, in kind of very fundamental level of science, we can isolate the particular thing we want to study, right? When we study electrons, we can usually just concentrate. So we can take one electron, let it move around and see what it does. And when you ask social science questions, it's much harder, right? It's really, really hard, right? It's really, right? And so that's why it's so amazing to get all these results, right? It also creates these kind of additional complexities, right? So that's why I'm always interested in reading social science papers, learning about all this research. But again, going back to one of the things we said in the very beginning, there is there's a lot of expertise. I mean, there's this kind of thing where it looks simple, right? And the study says we studied those things, right? But actually, there's a lot of expertise that, for example, I don't have in actually reading such papers and actually understanding, right? You wouldn't want to consult with me on social sciences, right?
Yeah. We're running out of time, but I just had like one last question just to wrap things up. You mentioned at the beginning that a lot of the reason why math can be intimidating for some first-year university students is that it's their first real exposure to the language. Do you think that maybe like an earlier exposure to mathematics at maybe like a high school level would be beneficial?
Yes. The issue is not the language. It's actually the way of thinking.
Yeah.
So the language of mathematics is actually something that is introduced in the school system. It could be done much better, but it is discussed in the school system. And I mean, more practice helps with that. Like the school system could slightly start at an earlier age, start things at an earlier age, so everyone would get more practice with everything. Especially in BC, I think things are more crammed toward the end of high school. And so there's no time to develop everything in a structured way. But overall, the language of mathematics is something that more or less happens in the schools. Let's say if students come out of high school with a calculus course, then they know how to write down a function differentiated some of these things. And schools are trying to introduce more probability, more other things that are part of the language of mathematics to describe indeed things like social science or life sciences question. But mathematics, the thing that is hardest and takes the longest to develop and is not so much in schools is actually the way mathematics is a way of thinking. It's mathematics as a field whose goal, I mean, the way of thinking, which is kind of, let's be doubtful of everything and let's make sure that what we write on is a rigorous proof, that everything we say is rigorously defined. That, right? So instead of saying, okay, this is true, let's say, why is this true? Instead of paying attention to how typical things behave, let's ask ourselves, can I come with an atypical thing in order to test the boundaries of everything and make sure that what I say is actually true? And this is kind of a mental discipline that takes a long time to develop. And that's the really hard part of mathematics. And that is mostly absent from mathematics in the schools, especially here. And so, for example, the parts of Math 100 that involves this kind of thinking are by far the hardest parts. And the courses that, and we have our honors program that completely concentrates on this program. And this makes these things much harder. And so, yes, I think that it would help to think about it earlier, but it's also something that's really hard to teach.
Right.
And so I can't tell you easily how to teach more of it, right? And there are certainly people who are thinking about it and working on it, including at UBC. We should in particular name Dr. Melania Alvarez, who mostly works through PIMS, who works on many problems related to teacher education and how to, she recently won a prize from the Canadian Mathematical Society exactly on this, on her work on this. This is a skill that's not so easy to teach and it takes a long time to teach and it has to kind of, it's something you have to develop over a long time. So it's the difference between teaching a student, if you see this kind of problem, this is how you solve it, and telling the student, here's a problem you've never seen before, figure out how to solve it. Right? And of course, I think this is important. I think this is the most valuable part in mathematics, right? I mean, let me give you another analogy, right? If you think about it, I mean, why do we teach students, why do we have students go to gym class in school, right? We don't have our kids go to gym class because they will run for transportation for the rest of their lives, right? And still, bicycles and cars and trains and so on do not obviate the need for gym class, right? Similarly, in mathematics, in many ways, the calculational aspects of mathematics are the least important parts, right? Wolfram Alpha or the other tool, I don't remember now, whether there's a different tool that's become more popular with the students, can pass our calculus exam, right? So on some level, I mean, this is, and using Wolfram Alpha is a bit like riding a car to go to campus, right? Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly normal and good thing to do, right? The real value in mathematics in many ways is in the way of thinking more than right. In the calculation, the ability to calculate. But it's actually very hard to teach, right? It's, again, if you think about gym class, which comes to mind, I do some physical activities, but it's easy. It's much easier to teach students how to, it's easy to teach students how to, let's say, take free throws repeatedly or things like this than to teach them how to feel how a basketball game should, what's the best thing to do in a particular situation, a basketball right. court. It's easier to take a music, it's easier to teach somebody how to mechanically move keys on the piano than how to be musical. We have to encourage people to challenge themselves, and we have to help them as they're challenging themselves. And we try to do that in our own classrooms at the university level, and we would like the school teachers to do the same in the schools. But this is something different.
Yeah, that's a good note to end things off on. Sorry, I know we didn't even get to start talking about the work on modular knots, but we can definitely have you on another time. We can continue the conversation. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. And today's interview was with Dr. Lior Zilberman, an associate professor in UBC's Department of Mathematics. We hope you tune in back to Research Review when we return in the new year on Wednesday, January 5th, 2022.